If everyone would kindly find a seat. When I was growing up, the people who sat in the front of the shul always were proud of the fact that they got the Mizrachwand. Now we have so many humble people in our communities that everyone always opts for the back of the shul. But in this presentation, there are seats up front. So for those who were standing in the back, there are seats up front, and please fill them. About a month and a half ago, when we really started planning this program and trying to decide who would be our very, very special guest of the speakers from out of town, I turned to Yeshivat Har Etzion, to Gush, and I asked if it was possible that one of the Ramim, one of the rabbis at the yeshiva, might be able to come, or might be in the United States at the time. And the initial response I got was, you know, it's right after Rosh Chodesh Elul. The Zman has just started, so it's not going to work. And then about a week later, I received an email that Rabbi Moshe Terrigan was willing to come. Rabbi Terrigan landed left last night from Israel. He landed this morning in Chicago. He's going back tonight to Israel. And in between, I'm sure he's going to be meeting with some of the Talmidim, the alumni of the yeshiva. And I truly want to thank him for coming in, not just for the brief period of time that he'll be in the States, but more importantly, for the shir he'll be delivering. Rabbi Terrigan was one of Yaakov's Ramim when he was at Har Etzion. We have known each other for many years. It has been a zchut to get to know him more and more over the years. He has had a profound impact on our community because of the many, many students that he has taught over the years, many of whom from Chicago and many of whom continue to come back to Chicago to help take positions of leadership within our community. The fact that Rabbi Terrigan is an extraordinary Talmud Chacham is an obvious statement. The fact that he is part of a yeshiva that has had an extraordinary impact on our community is an obvious statement. But what I do want to say is that he's also a very, very good friend, and I truly appreciate the fact that he came for this morning. Without any further ado, Harav Moshe Terrigan.
I was recently at a rabbinic convention, and I overheard a conversation between a Reform and conservative rabbi and the Orthodox counterpart. And the Reform and conservative rabbis approached the Orthodox rabbi and said, "Rabbi, we've been waiting to ask you this question for so many months. Finally, it's been bothering us. Why are your drushos so long Shabbos morning? Why are they so long?" So the Orthodox rabbi turns to his counterparts and says, "Well, you know, we're busy people. You have a lot of respected rabbanim here. You're busy the whole week learning, tending to the community, leading the community, visiting the ill. When do we get a chance to prepare our drasha? On the walk over Shabbos morning, you think about something to say and you give a drasha." So he turns to the Reform rabbi and says, "You drive to shul. It takes you about 5 minutes. So your drasha is 5 minutes. He turns to the conservative rabbi and says, "Well, you drive to shul, but you can't park in shul. So it takes you about 5 minutes to drive. You park a few blocks away. It takes you about 7 minutes. Now, if I'm Orthodox, I have to walk in the rain, in the sleet, in the cold. It takes me about a half an hour." So I was preparing my drasha on the flight last night. You handed out all parts? You got part 10 of the sheets? Or Mitenki assured me it's Labor Day, we only have 3 hours? Hey, Brishis Rabbanim, I don't see Rabbi Schwartz. I have to apologize to him in absentia for not being able to attend his drasha. I tried to get her as fast as possible. We were a little delayed at Eretz Yisrael. And Rabbi Mitenki, you've been a real model to me of elegance and of leadership and of calm and poise. And Rabbi Brand, I'm just so excited to hear that all the exciting things are just going through in order. And Rabbi Engel has been a real chaver and someone who you've shared so much enthusiasm and inspiration about our common yeshiva. And Rabbi Eisenberg, I want to thank you again for all your years of friendship and of camaraderie. As Rabbi Schwartz undoubtedly mentioned, Shemitah crystallizes a careful attempt to calibrate between an ideal and pragmatic concerns. Ideally, we'd like to maintain HaKadosh Baruch Hu's year of deceasing and desisting from all work, allowing the land to remain fallow, and creating an environment of Shabbos Lashem, an entire year of Shabbos. So I didn't get to welcome your wife. Thank you again for all your support, Mrs. Matemke. Yet as we live in a national situation in which agriculture has to be sustained, in which we're concerned with global national kashrus, people who aren't interested in keeping kosher, we're interested in them keeping kosher as well. So they had to mechira, the ability to sell the land and to maintain our normal routine, so to speak, during the year of Shemitah has become necessary. Rabbi Schwartz, I'm sure, addressed it. But undoubtedly, in Eretz Yisrael, some accept Heter Mechira, and some feel, in certain cases, that they're Machmir. They won't adopt the Chumrah and try to aspire towards a more comprehensive and accurate or authentic Shemitah observance. So I thought it may be appropriate, being that this shiur is bookended by two shiurim that are addressing Shemitah in particular, to discuss the role and the value and the experience of Chumrah in general. Now, Chumrah is a very charged word. It elicits very, very harsh responses. Some people never met a Chumrah they liked. Some people never met a Chumrah they didn't fall in love with. How to establish a healthy perspective, a healthy interaction, the very delicate and sensitive part of the lifestyle of a religious person. What roles do Chumrah play? When are they appropriate? How should they be employed? How should they be measured? And what are the dangers and potential pitfalls of the world of Chumrah? The concept of Chumrah is already addressed in one of the early Mishnayos of Pirkei Avos. Some of us read it yesterday. There's a minhag to extend Pirkei Avos until Rosh Hashanah. So for those who continue to read, we read it last night or yesterday. And if you take a look at source number four, Hey Mamru, the people of the Great Assembly, these were people who bridged between the prophetic era and the era of the Talmud and the Mishnah, the Anshei Knesset HaGadolah, they articulated three aphorisms, three cliches. One of them was, Have a mesunim adin, to be deliberate when you judge, hamidah tamidim harbe, to teach Torah as popularly as possible, to disseminate Torah. Source four, last three words, Ve'asu siag la Torah. This is one of the early mentions of the concept of chumrah. Chazal articulated the notion of chumrah with a four-letter word called siag. Samach, yud, yud, gimel. Siag comes from the word suga in Hebrew, in Tanakh, and refers to a wall. You may remember from Shir HaShirim, I don't believe I quoted the source, suga b'shoshanim, a wall protecting the roses, protecting the flowers. At its heart, a chumrah is a wall to prohibit otherwise permissible objects, people, or experiences, so that if chas v'shalom, an infraction happens, at least the roses, the garden, won't be trampled. The wall may be breached, hopefully not. Hopefully the wall will serve as a deterrent, as a barrier. But if, God forbid, the wall is breached, at least the inner precincts, and at least the roses, will remain intact. Namely, at its heart, a chumrah is a defensive measure meant as a protectant, to protect an area of halacha which requires protection. Now, some chumras have institutionalized themselves so early in our tradition that they no longer appear as chumras, but in their heart and nature, they are chumras. There is one chumra that HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself installed. We typically identify chumras as rabbinic insertions, rabbinic additions. There is one chumra about a particular area of halacha which HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself felt was necessary because the prohibited item is normally eaten, is normally permissible, and 1 week a year it's prohibited, and because of the danger, and because of the confusion, this area has to be guarded with a chumrah. Does anyone know which chumrah I'm referring to and which week I'm referring to? Pesach. Normally there are items we can't eat, but those items which are forbidden to eat or even forbidden to benefit from may be maintained. They can be possessed. A nazir can keep wine in his cupboard. You're allowed to hold basar b'chalav. You can't benefit, you can't eat it, but you can store it if you need to for whatever reason. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu told us not just to avoid eating chametz, kol machmetzes lo socheilu, not just to avoid hana, benefit from chametz, se'or lo yirai lecha chametz, lo yirai lecha se'or. You shouldn't even own it, you shouldn't interact with it. According to many commentators, this is actually a biblical chumrah. Because chametz, as Chazal say, labadol mineh. You eat it the whole year, you're too comfortable with it, it's too natural, and therefore, a wall. Suga, a siag is erected already in the Torah. Most chumras are rabbinic, most defensive chumras, but some of them are so primal and so seminal that they barely present themselves anymore as a chumra. For example, the world of Shabbos is encased in a very elaborate system of chumra that we feel is part of the innate, holistic part of Shabbos. What do we call the elaborate chumra of Shabbos that encases and avoids infraction? What do we call that chumra? Muktzah. In order to prevent carrying outside into Rosh Hashanah, in order to prevent malach infraction, the Rabbanan, according to most opinions, it's the Rabbanan, shrunk the amount of items we carry in general. We shouldn't be carrying items which aren't absolutely necessary to eat, to use, to enjoy. Anything that has no function, anything that can be used for a prohibited activity, shouldn't even be carried in your living room or in an enclosed circle. Muktzah is a chumra. It became institutionalized. We see it as integral to Shabbos. But it was inserted as a protective chumra. Another area in which chumra created layers of prohibitions that have become already mainstream, integral to the halacha, the world of sexuality. Halacha understood human impulses, human hormones, and the world of nida, Chazal tell us, Am Yisrael paid special attention to Taras HaMishpacha by extending and by sharpening some of our attention to the nida period. The dangers of sexual compulsion or sexual attraction were thereby muted. So these are certain areas in which early stage chumra, not chumra of a pasuk down the street in 2014, but Chazal already sensed the value and the import of a chumra. Either because they're so routine, like chametz, or because the impulses are so overwhelming, human sexuality, or because the experience is so central, Shemir Shabbos. Sometimes Chazal sensed the chumra and institutionalized the chumra, not because the lust was so powerful, because the experience was so significant and central, but because it was so routine and so part of our commonplace. You take a look at source number 7. Marokva compared himself to his father. He says, if I compare myself to my father, I come out looking like a donkey. How does he look like a donkey? He says, my father, when he ate meat, when he went to the shallots. I know there's a across the street from the yeshiva, I sometimes teach him. When he went to shallots, he waited 24 hours until he ate dairy. 24 hours. But myself, Bilu Anas, source 7, line 3, Bahasa Dusu de Lochilna, I don't eat for 6 hours or so, but six hours later, I take a dairy meal. Basar Bechala is so overwhelming that it's unavoidable. We have a tremendous lust to eat dairy after basar. But it's food. And we nosh, and we nibble, and our food habits change. And it's not because the experience was so daunting or the hormones were so overwhelming, simply because it's day-to-day routine that if not bounded and protected, can slip slide into carelessness and into infraction. So the source of a chumra, the baseline of a chumra, is to protect a particular area of halacha against infraction. HaKadosh Baruch Hu sensed it himself by inserting the iser to possess chametz. Chazal took their cue and addressed Shabbos, Taras HaMishpacha, eating, other areas, and created these protective layers or shells so that even if, God forbid, the shells are violated, the core, the kernel, will remain intact and will remain protected. Now the truth is a defensive chumra doesn't only have to be telescopic. It can also be systemic. How many Svardim? I see a lot of Ashkenazim in this room. This is a primarily Ashkenazi crowd. Are there any Svardim here? Okay. If you compare the Svardi world of Psak to the Ashkenazi world of Psak, one glaring difference emerges. In the world of Ashkenaz, starting from the Ramah, the great rabbi of Poland, who launched Torah in Poland, the Rambam of Poland, Rabbeinu Moshe Isserlein, is a proclivity towards chumra. Anytime a question arises, v'nagru l'hachmir, v'nagru l'hachmir. Whereas in the world of Svard, and we just are approaching the one-year yard site of Rabbi Avadya Yosef. We did so much in so many areas, but to once again project the world of Svardi Torah and the world of Svardi Psak. There's less of inclination towards Chumrah. There's more of a cool-headed balancing between Chumrah and Kula. Why is this so? One reason is because the world of Ashkenaz, the European Jewish world of Ashkenaz, was constantly under assault. Expulsions, migrations, being ported from continent to continent, suffering, inquisitions, pogroms. Under that context, the social fabric, which is so necessary, the family fabric, to maintain the continuity of Psak, the integration of halachic practice. You practice like your mother, like your grandparents. But what happens if you don't know your grandparents because they were massacred? What happens if you didn't get the chance to live with your parents because you were expelled or you were pogromed? So because the system is under attack, is under siege, the system has to be reinforced through Chumrah. Whereas Jews in Sephardic lands enjoyed relative stability. They studied with their parents, they viewed their grandparents' halachic performance, and the natural halachic evolution was allowed to flow, and that produced the confidence that allowed Svardi Poskim to adopt kulos more frequently than their Ashkenazic counterparts. There's an old joke in the yeshivas we used to tell, that if the Rama really wanted people to adhere to a particular halacha, you know what he should have written? Instead of writing Aser Lechal El Shabbos, you can't violate Shabbos, what he should have written is V'nahagu b'medinos Ashkenaz lo lechal el Shabbos. There's a minhag to keep Shabbos. Everyone stands at attention. The minhag to keep Shabbos, v'nahagu b'medinos Ashkenaz lo lesaper Lashon Hara. There's a minhag not to speak Lashon Hara. I'll never speak it again. Because the power and the strength of minhag was so valued because the system was under siege. So the first value of Chumrah is to protect, but protection can come in two varieties. It can protect a particular sphere or area of halachic experience, or it can protect the system in total. The second approach to Chumrah is not practical, but what I would call attitudinal. It demonstrates and reflects on the one hand, as well as generates and conditions on the other hand, how we view halacha, how we view halachic observance. Some of you may have read the very famous Musar Sefer written by Moshe Chaim Lutzato, Moshe David Lutzato, in the beginning of the 18th century, Mesilas Yesharim. He groups Zahirus, which is a general catchword for Chumrah, with the companion trait of Zrizus. The Zrizus we demonstrate in performing mitzvahs, in running to shul, in performing chesed, and attending to our mitzvahs. Is Zrizus a practical measure? The energy, the alacrity, the enthusiasm, the force? No, our Zrizus demonstrates our attitude towards mitzvahs. If we view a mitzvah as a burden, if we view it as an unfortunate task to be dispensed with, then we'll be lazy and procrastinate. But if we seize and view the mitzvah as an opportunity to interact with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then we attend to it in a timely and responsible fashion. So the energy that we bring to a mitzvah performance demonstrates, but also conditions, how we view our religious opportunities. Same thing with a chumrah. Adopting a chumrah oftentimes demonstrates as well as conditions. They tell a story about the Vilna Gaon. As you may or may not know, handling shells and bones left on a table on Shabbos is a very halachically complicated situation. If the shells and bones are completely inedible, then officially they're muktzah. They have to be dealt with appropriately. They can be removed, but there are guidelines and bylines. At one point, they delayed in removing the shells and bones from the table at which the Vilna Gaon was sitting. The Vilna Gaon saw these shells or bones, and he fainted. He was so unnerved by the notion of shells and bones presenting a potential halachic hazard. They quickly revived him, but they forgot to remove the bones. So they fainted again. So finally, his Rebbetzin had enough good sense to properly remove the bones and shells, and they revived him. Don't try this at home. But it demonstrates a certain perspective that sometimes in our world has eroded. Sometimes our perspective on halakhic activity is very casual, very relaxed, almost cavalier. Try our hardest. Put my best foot forward. no pain, no gain, I'll recover. All these cliches that we've culled from our culture. Sometimes when we superimpose them to our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to our performance and adherence to halacha, it's a bit lame. It's a bit hollow. Without fainting like the Vilna Gaon, do we sense that experiences, objects, activities which HaKadosh Baruch Hu prohibited are toxic or dangerous? To try our utmost to avoid them, and if chas v'shalom we have violated them, a sense of loss, not despair, not depression, but a sense of loss. The closest I think most of us come to is probably when we eat dairy a little too quickly. We forget that we're fleishiks and we eat dairy because it's in our souls, it's in our kishkes, and we feel a little bit uncomfortable because it's physical and it's visceral. What about other areas of halachic failure? Are we able to muster the same response without the fainting? I tell a story about Rav Moshe Feinstein, a similar story, who once consumed milk which wasn't Chalav Yisrael. The famous debate, was he makbid on Chalav Yisrael, was he not? Assuming he was, according to the way this story goes. And when he realized he ingested non-Chalav Yisrael, he ran immediately to the sink and forced himself to regurgitate. Again, I'm not citing this as an example for our emulation and to try to replicate, but a sense of loss, a sense of concern, a sense of worry. And chumrah isn't necessary only to protect infraction. It's attitudinal. It demonstrates that we view halacha with such gravitas, with such seriousness, punctilious observance, that from time to time we feel the chumrah will help us avoid general infractions. I was in the airport this morning and I hadn't eaten the whole flight, and I was running to catch in New York to Chicago, and I went to the Haagen-Dazs and I asked him if he's kosher, and he says he's kosher, but he showed me the jugs were kosher, so I didn't want to know if he's kosher. So the only thing I could find, Ben and Jerry's, that I could find was a chocolate bar. So I turned the chocolate bar over and it had a kosher signal, a symbol that I didn't recognize. And I was starving and I was exhausted. I took it, I was about to pay, and I said, I don't even know if this is kosher. There's so many different symbols out there. I just felt I'd rather be tired, I'd rather be weak than chas v'shalom eat something that may not be kosher. But attitudinal chumras are not only defensive. They can also be proactive. I mentioned before the source of chumrah. Rashi, source number one, highlights a defensive-minded chumrah. Rashi says, he talks about the chumrah of a nazir, and we'll return to a nazir who prohibits himself voluntarily from wine, from shaving his hair, from coming into contact with dead bodies. So Rashi says, why is the section of nazir juxtaposed to the section of a errant woman, of a deviant woman, of a sota? Source number one, lama nismacha parshas nazir la parshas sota, lomer lecha, to teach us, shekol haroa sota bikulkula. Man witnesses the depravity and the degeneracy of a sota, of a woman who wanders. He's horrified. And in response to that horror, yazir atzmo min hayayin. He retreats from wine, he retreats from physical indulgence. Namely, the classic portrait of a defensive chumrah, if not practical, because he's not worried about being an errant woman, at least attitudinal. He's worried about halachic infraction. He sees how flimsy, he sees how vulnerable the human condition is in the context of this errant woman, this Isha Sota, so he retreats from physical indulgence. It's a very famous story about Shimon HaTzadik. Shimon HaTzadik was actually one of the last members of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, about which I mentioned earlier. Shimon HaTzadik had contact with Alexander the Great, very famous stories in which he encountered Alexander the Great during some of his wars. Source number 14, Shimon HaTzadik said, Miyamai lo achalti Hashem Nazir. I never wanted to partake of the karban offering of a Nazir. A Nazir is a very ambiguous experience, as we'll talk about later. There are pros and cons. There are reasons to celebrate the act of Naziris and reasons to be cautious. So Shimon HaTzadik always withdrew from partaking of the asham karban of a nazir. Some of it goes to the Kohen, as you know. Shimon never wanted to be part of that karban. Except for one nazir who particularly impressed him. Listen to the story. Some of you who studied Greek mythology probably will recognize this story. He met a nazir from the south, Baruch Hashem. We now can sit in this room and be thankful to our Kodesh Baruch Hu that our citizens in the south are once again able to maintain their lifestyle and to lead their lives. Baruch Hashem, we're still struggling for our land. So this was a Nazir who came from the south, a Nazir from Sderot, a Nazir from Otef Aza or something. He came to Shimon HaTzadik. Yifei Naim B'tov Roi. He was beautiful, attractive eyes, very handsome. V'kvutzosav Sderot Slo Taltalim. And his hair was very comely. I asked him, my son, why did you choose the root of Nazir? So he answered, source number 14, line number 4. I went to draw water because I was a shepherd. V'nistakalti bivuashali. And in the water I saw my image reflected. Ufachaz yitzri. And I was so enchanted with my own beauty, I was terrified. I was shooken. Amartilo. I told my own inner vanity, my own inner ego. Reika, empty head. Why are you so enchanted? Why are you so enthused about a transient world which isn't yours? One day you'll be worms and dust. Havoda, I raised my hand and off. And I'm going to walk away from this possible enchantment. I'm going to walk away from this fantasy. I'm going to take a few steps back from this dangerous route. And Shimon HaTzadik was so impressed with the integrity and the honesty of this Nazir, that despite his general resistance, his general reluctance to partake of an Hashem Nazir, he partook of this carbon. So Rashi already notes that Nazir is the paradigm for healthy defensive Chumrah, and Shimon HaTzadik experienced that defense mechanism in a particularly impressive Nazir whose carbon he partook of. But who was the first Nazir in history?
Shimshon.
Classic answer. And we'll talk about Shimshon in a second. The first Nazir in history was actually Yosef. And we'll read about it in a few weeks. If you take a look at source number 6, Umimeged Aretz Umloa, this is describing the bounty of Yosef's portion. Umimeged Ertzon Shochniseh Sineh. Tavosa l'rosh Yosef ulekadkod nazir echav. Chazal tell us that Yosef preceded all the Nazirim for obvious reasons. He was vulnerable, he was trapped, he lived under siege, in this case sexual predation of his master's wife. At some point he realized he had to take a few paces back. Again, a defensive-minded Nazir. But as you mentioned, I'm sorry, your name?
Karen,
as Karen mentioned, more popularly, the first Nazir in Tanakh, this is Chazal's interpretation, more popularly, the first Nazir in Tanakh is Shimshon, and the second Nazir in Tanakh is Shmuel, each of whom was announced as a Nazir before they were born. Their Nazirus was not in response to potential danger, as Yosef's was, as Rashi's description is, as the Shimon HaTzadik Nazir interaction presents. Why is Shimshon a Nazir? Why is Shmuel a Nazir? Not to protect, not to defend, but to jumpstart. The Jewish people in Sefer Shoftim are stuck in national inertia. Sefer Shoftim is a pathetic book. When the book ends, they're no closer to redemption and monarchy than when they begin. One step forward, two steps back. HaKadosh Baruch Hu intervenes, miracles, opportunities, and we fail him. And we betray him, and we're stuck in the squalor of internecine battle and struggle and civil war. It's a sad book. And these are two people who can potentially, one fails, one succeeds, who can potentially jumpstart Jewish history. And that energy is provided by a chumrah, by creating a different reality, a different norm, a different set of behavioral circumstances. So often our challenges in life are not the challenges of religious regression. But we become stuck in ruts and in routines. We lose our energy. We go about our religious business robotically, mindlessly, routinely. And the challenge is not protecting against backslide as much as providing energy and vision. And sometimes a chumrah can provide just that energy. My Rebbe Reb Lichtenstein told me that after finishing his smicha in Yeshiva University, he went to Harvard to study English literature. And he was worried. New area, he needs new energy, new commitment. So he decided to adopt a chumrah when he went to Harvard. So we asked Sim Rebbe, which chumrah did you adopt? He said he decided to wash mayim achronim with a kli. Instead of just dipping his hands in water, he'd be makbid to take a kli and wash mayim achronim. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein was worried that he had a taiva not to wash mayim achronim. This is a defensive chumrah. This is a proactive chumrah. To continue religious search, maybe under challenging circumstances. Meretz Hashem, we're a few weeks away from the Aseres Yemei Tshuva. Take a look, please, at source number 9. The Rama quotes in Shulchan Aruch, Af mi she'eino nisar mipas shel kusim. Even people who normally eat Dunkin' Donuts, kosher food, but it isn't baked by Jews, it's not Pas Yisrael. There's a minog, ba'aseres yimei tshuva tzarech le'em, I'm not passing you, Chas V'Shalom, but the Rama quotes a minog, some people are extra careful during the 10 days to only eat Pas Yisrael. This is a defensive chumrah. What are we trying to butter up a Kadosh Baruch Hu? This is unctuous. What? Tarte mashma. Butter up a Kadosh Baruch Hu. There's a sense that during the 10 days of tshuva, a person wants to seek higher religious ground, higher religious consciousness, and that higher ground can't just be achieved internally, it has to correspond to external measures. And each person adopts those measures. So very often a chumrah is not just defensive in a practical sense, but it's attitudinal. But even attitudinally, it doesn't come to defend our perspective on halacha, but to create energy. I find myself in my own time, in my own experience, is struggling with davening. Chazal want us to struggle with davening. Chazal say, Arba devarim tzrichim chizuk. There are four parts of our religious experience which constantly have to be reinforced and reexamined and improved. And one of them is tefillah, because tefillah is so routine, and tefillah is so commonplace, and because HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence isn't visceral or palpable, we have to sense it, and tefillah is standing in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Kaveh El Hashem, the Gemara says, Chazak v'yameh tzlibecha v'kaveh El Hashem. So a couple of years ago, I started to say Tehillim Shel Yom, the section for that day of the month, and it radically changed my tefillah. Because every day has its own style and its own rhythm and its own psukim that I haven't said in a month as opposed to repeating the same psukim again and again. So these are the three or four positive opportunities, positive horizons of a chumrah. Number one, at its heart, it's a siyag, a wall meant to protect either a particular area of halacha, Shabbos, chametz, hilchos taras hamishpacha, Basur B'chalav, or to protect the system, as we send so often in the world of Ashkenaz P'sak, can also be attitudinal. I mentioned the word siyag before. The actual word the Torah uses for a chumrah is not the word siyag. If you take a look at source 2, v'shamru es mishmarti. The word mishmarti. Rashi quotes, v'shamru es mishmarti. Source number 3, the Gemara quotes, asu mishmeres le mishmarti. Chazal's definition of chumrah was a siyag, was a wall. The Torah's word for chumrah, at least according to Rashi, is a guard. Sometimes we station guards, not to protect an invasion, but to demonstrate our attitude towards that area. So if you visit Buckingham Palace, the guards don't stand at attention to prevent tourists from walking in, or to prevent France from invading. The guards are stationed to show honor, importance, pomp, regality. The Levim and the Beis HaMikdash surrounded the Mikdash to demonstrate this is an important place. When a person walks up, an important person walks up to have a bracha on the chuppah, people accompany him. But because they're protecting him, because we show and we demonstrate our attitude to something important by creating attention, by creating presence. So when the Torah describes a chumrah through mishmeres, it tries to exploit the attitudinal element, not necessarily the practical element. So those are some of the positive horizons of chumrah. Practically, attitudinally, to demonstrate our perspective towards halacha, or to jumpstart religious energy in general. What about the dangers? I tried to make it equivalent time for the chumras, for the potential risks of chumrah, as well as the potential opportunities. One of the first concerns which Chazal had about chumrah is voiced by a Gemara. If you take a look at source number 13, Now, source number 12. I think we actually skipped them. Source number 12. It's a very famous debate between Rebbe Eliezer HaKapar and Rebbe Lazza. And the debate stems from a riddle, an enigma, in Parshas Naso describing a Nazir. On the one hand, he's called Kadosh. On the other hand, he offers a Karban Chatas. And it's very clear that a Karban Chatas is not in response to his failed Nazirus term, even if he succeeds. He brings a Karban Chatas. You can imagine a Nazir who fails, who comes into contact with Tumah, who shaves his head, who drinks wine, he has to bring a Karban Chatas. But according to the Pesukim, every Nazir brings a Chatas. So it's a very enigmatic experience. Sir Detanya, Belazar Akapar, Berebi Omer, Matam and Lomer, Vechiper Alav Measher Chatala Nefesh, Vechibe Eze Nefesh Chataze, Elashet Seer Atzmo Min Hayayim. By depriving himself from wine, he has committed a chait. Rebbe Lazar disagreed. Rebbe Lazar Omer Nikra Kadosh, and obviously, we can integrate those two opinions. The person can both be Kadosh and Chote, as we all are. As we all are. When the Rambam describes our perspective on this world, should we flee from this world? Should we embrace it? Should we indulge in this world or should we deny it? The Rambam is very insistent on that middle path. When it comes to halachic observance, mitzvot, Torah, tefillah, we're meant to be extreme, unconditional, unrestrained. But how do we view our world? I mentioned before the Mesilas Yesharim. The Muslim movement emerged in the beginning of the 18th century, and it was dominated by a perspective that this world is demonic and empty of meaning. The world is full of devils. Everything is illusory and transient. And a person should avoid as much as possible any interaction with this world. And then there was a backlash. There was a second school of Musar that opened in response. It was known as, by and large, the Slabatka school of Musar, centered around the great yeshiva in Slabatka, led by Rav Dassin Tzvi Finkel, the Alter of Slabatka. And his perspective was the world is full of potential and opportunity. And man is the pinnacle of creation. And Hashem empowered you to change and redeem this world. And if you sink beneath your station, it's a tragedy. I spoke to someone who learned in Slabatka, and he told me, in the original Muslim movement, this was the difference. If an attractive woman walks down the street, you know what the response is meant to be? Rima Vitaleya, she's dust, she's worms. Why should I be attracted to something so fleeting and ephemeral? But in Slabatka, if an attractive woman walks down the road, you should tell yourself she's beautiful. But I'm a prince. And I have too many more cosmic, important details to attend to and to sacrifice and forfeit those missions for this passing pleasure. As he told me, in Slabatka, you only needed two words to learn Musar. In Slabatka, I know the Yiddish people will understand this, you only needed two words. Which two words? Pasnisht. Pasnisht. Someone in your station, pasnisht, to do that. And not that the activity is undignified, but it's pasnisht for you, you're a prince. You're better than that. How do we distill these two worlds, these two views? This is an entrance. The next world is the palace. Should we ignore the entrance for the sake of the palace? Of course, we have to prioritize the palace. But how do we respond or relate to the entrance? So the Rambam insists on the middle road. The Rambam writes, source 13, Shema Yomer Adam, maybe a person will become enchanted with the classic Musar approach. Hakina, Hatayiva, Vakava, the world is suffused with jealousy and pettiness and lust and egotism. Matsinus Adam in Olam, line number 2, source 13, Efrosh Me'em Biyosir, I want to distance myself as much as possible. Vesrachek Litzad Achron, I don't want to eat meat, I don't want to drink wine, I don't want to marry, I want to be celibate. Lo Yishep Adira Na, I want to live in a hovel. I don't want to dress appropriately, line 4. Kagon Kani Ovde Kochavim, like the priests and monks in a monastery, deprive themselves, ascetic lifestyles. Gamze derech rahi. That is an inappropriate, that is a dangerous attitude. The aser lelechba, and you are forbidden from addressing that or approaching that. Hamahalich b'derech zu nikra chote. If you're too self-deprivational, too self-flagellating, too detached, you're a chote. Sheomer ben Nazir, and he quotes the example of a Nazir, v'fiper alav me'asher chata l'nefesh. She's a sinner. The first crime of a Nazir is that he alters the very, or a chumra in general, is that you alter the very delicate balance that HaKadosh Baruch Hu installed in our world. There are activities which are forbidden, and activities which at the very least are permissible, maybe even endorsed and advisable. By adding, inflating the system, you disrupt that harmony. You destabilize that very delicate balance. And you run the risk of casting religion and casting our interaction with this world in dark, dangerous, guilt-ridden experiences and tones. One of the things I have to say, as the years roll on, sometimes these images become sharper in your mind. Yaakov, Zecharonu Livracha, had a very, very healthy sense of this balance. He's a very intense person, and kids picked it up, and teachers picked it up, and people in camp picked it up. But there was an inner calm and a happiness and a satisfaction with life and a joy. It's a very, very unique quality. And it wasn't outspoken. It wasn't outspoken in that sense. He didn't articulate it in philosophical terms. He didn't sit and talk about this Muslim woman or that Muslim woman. There was a healthiness and a joy in life that we all picked up. And I was reading this, Rambam was thinking about the schus that I had, and Meretz Hashem, his schus should be for all of Am Yisrael. That's the first danger of a Nazir. Casting religion in imbalanced terms. And that's the danger of Chumrah. The second dangers of Chumrah stem from a different analogy. Not between Chumrah and Nazir, but between Chumrah and a very interesting, intriguing parallel. The Gemara says in Nidarim, source 15, Rabbi Yonasan Omer, Hanoder, Ki'ilu Bana Bama. Person takes a neder, which for our purposes is the equivalent of a nazir, adding prohibited items. I'm not going to eat fruits, I'm not going to partake of this experience, I won't walk in this area, I won't talk to this person, I'm not a neder. He's considered as having built a bama. Bama were these personal shrines that were permissible until the mikdash was constructed. You could construct a personal hilltop in your backyard and offer a carbon to HaKadosh Baruch Hu without following the standard procedure of entering the mikdash and processing it with the kohen. Chazal had very ambivalent thoughts or perspectives upon bama, as did the Nevi'im. This Gemara certainly suggests a negative or critical view of a bama. And the same critical view of bama, so to speak, is superimposed or overlaid to a neder or potentially a chumrah. What is the danger of chumrah in relation to a bama? So I want to mention three issues. Number one, Judaism seeks centralization of religious experience. Everyone should enter Yerushalayim, one place, one location. Lo yizbechu od l'sirim mashal penei asada ve'achaltem sham l'fnei Hashem elokeichem. Everyone should be congregating in Yerushalayim. Part of that is theological. If Hashem is one, then the site in which we stand in front of Him must be unitary. We take monotheism for granted. We have introduced monotheism to this world. We converted a world from paganism to monotheism, from polytheism to monotheism. Most of the world believes in one God, and that's our triumph. But the centralization of Yerushalayim, the Beis HaMikdash, is not just theological, it's also experiential. What happens when there are more and more sites to worship HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Everyone has their own private bama. Everyone has their own shrine. Everyone has their own location. It's called inflation. What's the consequence of inflation? Devaluation. If there's one site, one location, one epicenter, that's sacred, it's unique, it's suffused with the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If everyone has their own personal site, then that central location becomes devalued. I can go here, I can visit there. The same danger threatens halacha. Once we inflate halacha with chumras, once we add, and we inflate it, the core of halacha itself becomes devalued, and we lose the ability to differentiate between halacha proper and a chumra. And that differentiation is crucial. There's one word my children know I'll never use about something which is not forbidden. I'll never say it's aser. They said, Abba, can I do this on Shabbos? Either I'll say aser, or I'll say nis Shabbos stick. Not aser. It's nis Shabbos stick. My Rebbe, Rav Amital, Zichrono Livracha, would implore us. There's a difference between the way you say Kriya Shema every morning and the sequence by which you put your shoes on in the morning. Some people follow the Kabbalistic sequence in the Shulchan Aruch, left shoe, left shoe, you tie. Some do, some don't. But that's Kabbalah. That's a minhag. Can you differentiate between your engagement in a minhag? And when you're being Mekabel Malchus Shemayim, Pamayim Mechol Yom? Or does it become one large inchoate system of halachic do's and don'ts? Without the ability to discern, to appreciate, to breathe meaning, and to draw meaning from Kriya Shema, from Tefillin, from Talmud Torah, from Sukkah, as opposed to the areas of our life which are chumras. Terming every experience aser threatens the integrity of that which is really aser. But that which is really, it leads to inflation, and the byproduct of inflation is devaluation. It also challenges us in our reaction to other people. Baruch Hashem, there's so many rabbis here, and they're working feverishly to build communities of inclusion. We want to include as many Jews as we can in our communities. But we all have to draw lines, and I'm sure we're all struggling to draw lines. How do we define our orthodoxy? What does it take to be part of an Orthodox community? Can you be part of an Orthodox community even if you may not be loyal to the classic standard Orthodox approaches? But how often do we draw communal lines along chumras? Well, since you eat this hashgacha, you trust that chumras, so you can't be part of our shul, you can't be part of our family, you can't be. This is the major challenge we will face next year in Eretz Yisrael. Some will keep a heter mechira, as Rabbi Schwartz mentioned. Some won't keep a heter mechira. How do we counsel ourselves? How do we counsel a student? You show up at someone's house. They're choosing, by the way, I'm not sure which is a bigger chumrah. 14 years ago, I refused to eat the heter mechira. I felt like I wanted to raise the standard of my Shemitah experience. I only ate Gentile produce. 7 years ago, I literally was nauseous at the notion of eating Gentile produce. Because most of the Gentile produce came from Gaza, came from Hamas terrorists. So now I'm going to sit with my badatz meal, I'm basically funding terror. I don't know what it will be like this year. We're still discovering. We're inching closer toward Shmir observance. I remember sitting on a plane 7 years ago with the Haredi. He had his badatz meal. I said, I can't eat this meal. I didn't say it in a militant fashion. I just simply can't eat it. I can't literally stomach putting this food into my mouth. But let's say you feel that Gentile produce or Israeli produce that isn't based on the Heter Mechira is superior. Let's say you show up at someone's house where the food is Heter Mechira food. That's an opportunity, potentially. Maybe you could plan in advance. Maybe you could ask the people to accord to your requests. But potentially to suspend the chumrah on behalf of Kavod HaBrios. Halacha is immutable. When it comes to the core halacha, ain etza, ain tfuna keneged Hashem. You can never, an Orthodox Jew can never suspend halachic fidelity for the sake of convenience or personal interaction. Remember last year there was this picture that went viral about a Kohen that flew a plane and put himself into a plastic bag and everyone was laughing and mocking him. And I gave a shiur that, and my point was, as much as we may mock this particular behavior, and you should have avoided it, taken a different flight, taken a boat somewhere, every single Jew has their bag moment. Every single Orthodox Jew has that moment in which you're facing a conflict between halachic observance and personal convenience and how you appear, and we know what we have to choose. I chose it this morning in Newark Airport, davening proudly in front of the United counter, not hiding my Judaism. I remember a long time ago, Joe and Susan, my brother-in-law's parents are here. So we went out with a family friend to a restaurant in Yerushalayim. This was a family friend who was always tagging along with my family. My brother-in-law is Jeremy Amon, Joe and Susan's son, so we get together a lot. And this was the night for this family friend who was always like the fifth wheel with our entire Baruch Hashem large family, all my brothers and sisters and children. He's always the fifth wheel. This was his night to take the entire group out for dinner. So he chose the restaurant. There's a restaurant in Yerushalayim called El Gaucho's. Evidently, they take their meat very seriously there, more serious than in Chicago. So I'm the elder person in my family, and they consulted with me about the kashrus. So I went into the kitchen before we sat down. I inquired about the kashrus. It wasn't the standard that I would have preferred. So I counseled everyone to order the chicken. This is not just a restaurant where you have the opportunity to order meat. The waitress came over to the table and said, you can have 500 grams, 250 grams, it could be well roasted, not roasted. It's like an entire sheer about which types of meat you could order. This is a serious meat restaurant. So my first brother or brother-in-law or sister says, I'll have the chicken. Her jaw drops. You don't order chicken in El Gaucho's. It's like worshiping the Pope in Mecca. It's sacrilegious. Comes over to the next person, gives the entire presentation, this type of meat, that type of meat, the jawbone, this bone, chicken. Her jaw drops. She goes to this table, about 15 adults, chicken, 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 chicken. And I see this friend of the family starting to get a little bit suspicious. What's happening? And I feared for his honor, for his comfort. So the waitress came to me and she gave me the entire presentation. And I said, I'll have the choicest steak well done that you can prepare. And all my brothers-in-law's jaws dropped. So from now on, whenever we order, the rule is I order first. That's the rule in our family. You go to him first, then we order. But how could I impose my own chumrah to someone else's discomfort? The language of chumrah is hamachmir al atzmo, tavo la bracha. If you're machmir on yourself, it's personal. God forbid to inconvenience another human being and to insult them with your chumrah. That's not a chumrah, that's a kula. That's a violation of Kavod HaBriah. It's not a chumrah. Now it's a two-way street. Sometimes we have, on the receiving end, we have to be willing and eager to accommodate other people's chumras. My Rebbe Reb Lichtenstein once gave a speech in New York City at a very posh shul in New York City, and it was a very provocative title, flipping out, frumming out about the trend of boys and girls going to Israel, coming back with higher halachic standards, making demands of the parents. And Rav Lichtenstein told the following story. He said that his own son, one of his children, became more Haredi. And after deciding his future, he requested of his parents that they should adopt certain chumras in their kitchen. Because Rav Lichtenstein's kitchen, and more so, Tova Lichtenstein's Soloveitchik's kitchen, wasn't kosher enough for him. So Rav Lichtenstein said, what was my response? I'll never forget this. He says, I gladly cooperated. If your child, Chas Hashem, has an allergy, wouldn't you accommodate? Child has a dietary need, they want to be a vegetarian, wouldn't you try your hardest to accommodate? So as long as it's respectful, as long as it's cooperative, it's a two-way street. Not just on the part of the chumrah adopter, not to inconvenience other people, but the chumrah subject, or the subject of the chumrah request, to try their hardest to accommodate. Taking away all the inner associated charged ideas of chumrah. Someone has a chumrah, says, they're chumrah. Can I help accommodate them? Can I help participate in that chumrah as best as possible? So the first danger of a chumrah is the inflation and the inability to discern between the core halacha and the chumrah per se. And the greatest danger that leads to is, of course, once the chumrah falls, perhaps the entire halachic system will fall. One of the earliest critiques of a chumrah cited source number 10 in Abbas Rebbe Nassim. This is a parallel work to Perkei Avos. No one less than, I think it's Rav Meir who said it, Tibiosi Mikan Amru, source number 10, part 2, line 2, Mikan Amru, Im Saga Dam Lidvarav Ein Yachol Amo Bidvarav, too much of a chumrah, you won't be able to maintain halachic practice. Mikan Amru, Al Yosef Adam Al Dvarim Sheshomea, don't add to what you've heard. Tova Sarat Tvachim Viomed, it's better to build a wall of 10 cubits that stands. Mimea Amav and Ophel, from a towering wall of 100 amos that falls. And of course, Chazal tell us that Chava, the great fall of man, was predicated by a chumrah. She was told not to eat. She presented it to the Nachash as if she shouldn't touch. The Nachash pushed her. She touched. Oh, well, if this is bunk, then everything is bunk. So that's the first danger of Bama, to differentiate between the core and between the additive. The second danger of Bama. What makes Bama so attractive? What makes that personal shrine in your backyard so appealing as opposed to walking through the Beis HaMikdash? Going to the Beis HaMikdash? It's a procedure. It's a process. To attend the mikvah. To consult with the Kohanim. To process the animals in the proper fashion. Your backyard Bama? It's immediate. It's unofficial. It's rapid. It's instant. You know the great appeal of Chumrah and the danger of Chumrah? It seduces us. It transfixes us by providing instant firm. Real religious growth is organic and staged. You work at it. You develop it. You walk rung by rung. I was always jealous of the Haredi world. Jealous, seethingly jealous. Because in that world, it was so easy for a 17-year-old boy to walk to Israel on August 27th as a high school kid and wake up August 28th as a yeshiva bacher and a firm person. How? Put on a black hat. Now I have the hat on, now I'm a firmer. And we didn't have that in our world. I was jealous. How can I take my Talmud and give him instant firmkeit? Baruch Hashem, in the last 10 years, we recovered. It's not a hat, it's a string, and it's not black, and it's blue. Come to Israel, they get the tzitzis down to the bottom of their knees, the long tchelas. Now I'm a yeshiva bacher, because I'm wearing tchelas down to my ankles. For 44 years of my life, I didn't put on tchelas. I didn't feel comfortable wearing tchelas in the presence of my Rebbe, Reb Lichtenstein, who doesn't wear tchelas. I'm going to prance around in my tchelas right in front of my Rebbe. 4 years ago, I taught Maseches Menachos. I went through all the sugyos of tchelas with my Talmidim. I caved. My Yetzirah gave in. I just had such a Yetzirah to put on tchelas after seeing all the halachos. But it was a stage. It was natural. I came to it naturally. Sometimes our chumros are inserted disproportionately in ways that don't fit the total body of our religious work and behavior. I mentioned Rav Amital before, who told me the following story. He once was giving a ride to a boy who was going to Yerushalayim. And the boy asked him, should I wear wool tzitzis? Our angle is nodding, he probably remembers the story. Should I wear wool tzitzis? The famous machloka, should the fabric of the tzitzis be wool, or could it be cotton or possibly other material? So the Rambam paskins wool. Sheikh Aruch says, you can wear any material of tzitzis, but a Yirei Shemayim should wear wool. So this Talmud asked Rav Amital, should I wear wool because I want to be Yirei Shemayim? So Rav Amital told him, you're reading the Shulchan Aruch differently from the way I'm reading it. You're reading it that if you want to become a Yirei Shemayim, put on wool tzitzis. I'm reading it, if you are a Yirei Shemayim, then put on wool tzitzis. If you've reached the stage in your overall religious practice and now it's appropriate, put it on. And as an artificial, disjointed part of general religious practice. I'll just summarize briefly because I know I'm stretching the time limit. That's the second danger of Chumrah. That's the second danger of Bama. To walk through the Beis HaMikdash, it's mikvah, it's kanin, it's korbanos, it's rules, it's guidelines. The Bama, walk right up, have breakfast, bring my karban. Chumrah has to be a natural, organic element of our overall religious experience. Not chas v'shalom, something artificial. Doesn't fit. And to conclude, the third danger of a Chumrah in its association with the Bama is as follows. What also makes the Bama attractive? The Beis HaMikdash, it's so commonplace. Everyone walks through the gates. Thousands of Jews, hordes of people are walking through. I'm just one amongst many. I'm nameless. I'm faceless. This is my Bama. This is my chance to shine. This is my place. I'm unique. Very often people choose chumras to project and to grandstand their religion for others. Because they want people to see how firm they are. And that's not just unfortunate, that's ugly. That's taking something pure and personal and preening, becoming exhibitionist. Yeshiva Bachru comes back from davening from Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael and davens with RPMs, revolutions per minute, 80 miles an hour.
Why is it everyone should see how long a Shemoneh Esrei is? Now I'm a tzaddik. I want everyone to see them. Not a tzaddik unless everyone knows it. You want to take a churma? Be machmir on kibbutz avayim. You want to take a churma? Be machmir on lashon hara. You want to take a churma? Be machmir on other areas of halacha that are private. The churma is best realized in the privacy between you and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's the third danger. I'll just end my shiur with another quote from my Rebbe Rav Amital, who asked us once, could you imagine if instead of taking an esrog in shul and eating maror at home at your table, what if it were reversed? What if you took an esrog in the privacy of your home, but you brought maror to shul? What would happen? People would spend a few pennies on the esrog, but maror, they'd spend millions of dollars. Why do we spend so much money on the esrog? So people should see our esrog in shul. Look at the pitum, look at the shape, look how yellow it is. We walk around. The situation were reversed. We'd walk in the shul with our bags of lettuce. Look how the stalks look how green it is. Look at the shape, look how white the spine is. Because we're looking to impress people. And that's the final danger of chumrah in its association with bama. So to summarize, chumrah is a very, very precious part of a serious-minded religious person's lifestyle. It can protect particular areas. It can jumpstart religious energy. It can demonstrate an overall vigilance as well as condition that vigilance. But in the right proportion, in the right context, at the right time. Sometimes a chumrah threatens to upset the balance with which we view our world. A very delicate balance of indulgence and retraction. Sometimes a chumrah inflates the system and both tarnishes and blurs the integrity of real halacha and our ability to apply halacha versus our application. Halacha has to be applied universally and unconditionally. Chumras are applied selectively and contextually. A chumrah sometimes offers us instant gratification, instant religious growth. And it shouldn't be. It should be an outcome, not an artificial trigger. And finally, we have to be careful that our chumras don't compromise that tznius, because then we've given up something greater and deeper than that particular chumra. It's Hashem should be as eternal for Yaakov Mishami for Shabbat.
I thank, on behalf of all of us, Rabbi Terrigan. The final presentation with Rabbi Brand will be beginning in 2 minutes.